On Friday, a 48-hour deadline to cease hostilities along the border of South Sudan and Sudan expires, with the threat of further sanctions against both nations unless they join at the negotiating table to find a solution to the current crisis over border definition and oil exports. On Friday, however, South Sudan accused Sudan of launching an airstrike on one of its oil regions, further weakening hopes for the ceasefire between the two former civil war foes. Khartoum has denied the charge. Sister Patricia Murray is executive director of the Solidarity with South Sudan organization. She spoke to Lydia O'Kane about her concerns for the civilian population, often forgotten in the war over oil exports and border demarcation.
I just want to come back for a slight minute to the independence of South Sudan and Sudan. Would it not have been a good idea for them to finalize the border before they had independence? There seems to be this question mark over where the borderline lies. Why is that?
I suppose borders are very sensitive things, and they're not easily defined, because one of the big questions about defining a border is how far back do you go to decide this is the border? So you can, in any country, you can point to divisions of land at particular historical moments that differ. And I think what happened in what you're looking at in South Sudan is borders that were there when the British and the Egyptian, the condominium government, came in. And Africa, by and large, wouldn't be in a land of borders, because people moved from one place to the other. So the colonizer brought in the idea of borders. And so then you had the border that was there when independence happened in 1955. And at that stage, they were moving towards dividing the whole of Sudan into four areas and having a kind of federal system. And unfortunately, that plan fell through. And then I think since 1955, the government of Sudan redefined borders within the country. But you always have the local knowledge of where people know borders were. I know from my own country in Ireland. We have the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. And they were contentious at times. So the international community is challenged in a lot of different areas about borders. I actually had an uncle who was in the diplomatic service. He worked, he was based for a number of years at the United Nations. And a lot of their time at that stage was looking at borders and frontiers, both on land and in sea. So if you think of it in today's world, there are many areas that are contested, whether people own islands or a rock in the sea, because a lot of it is to do with the resources. So sometimes you hear, why is a country claiming that little bit of territory in some part of the world? And you'll find that it's the potential of finding rich resources in that area. Whether it's mineral resources or oil or even fishing rights. So borders are very difficult things. Whereas, I could say to you simply, it would be great if the borders had been settled before. If we look at the history of setting borders, it is one of the most difficult tasks. And it requires negotiation and probably some compromise.
So was it almost inevitable then that conflict would arise with this question over borders?
Inevitable is too strong a word, but I think borders were always going to be a challenge. Whether one would always hope that borders can be negotiated in a peaceful way. But in the case of Sudan, there's a lot at stake in terms of oil and the location of oil within under the ground. And whether, particularly as the oil region is in the area which is directly, the border is cutting through it. So every gain or loss of land in that area is obviously going to be quite significant economically.
You were talking about oil there, and you were talking about disputes that go on. One dispute has been the Heglig area, around that area where there is oil, and obviously that's caused a lot of contention between the two nations.
It has, and but also you could point to Abyei, which is another area that I think, if I understand it correctly, the north came into the area of Abyei, which is an area claimed by the south, and then the south moved into the area of Heglig, which is an area claimed by the north. So in a way, you have, it shows you that there's a lot of area along the whole border, and others would point to areas near Central Africa and the Darfurian area, that's a contested area also, but there isn't as much at stake there. So it will take probably years of negotiation. Like, I don't think borders are settled easily. It'll take compromise. It will take intervention by international bodies who work with governments to bring resolution. But I always, I remember several times hearing in South Sudan people saying, that the resources that are under the land of Sudan, north and south, there was a kind of a generosity of sharing. And the pity is that kind of generosity could be hardened and people take up positions that can lead to conflict. I mean, there's always the opportunity of working as good neighbours to try and find a solution. Not an easy thing to do.
What's the general feeling of the South Sudanese people?
Well, I've talked to many of the members of Solidarity with South Sudan. We are in communication with them. And I suppose the people have suffered so long. But they're also aware that claiming, if you like, territorial claims are important in the life of a new country. And on the one hand, there's obviously a great desire that the peace will last. And I think that's from, there are certainly the sentiments being expressed by the leaders in the country. But on the other hand, the ordinary people are very supportive of the leadership, but also realising that they want to be treated with dignity as a new nation. And life becomes hard, because when the oil has been cut off, it means that town power and the price of fuel isn't there. The price of fuel has increased. Even the price of ordinary goods is increasing every day. And that's very hard on ordinary people. Mm. However, there's a kind of an acceptance that whatever will be. And a feeling that this is an important time in the life of the people. And yet the churches are obviously appealing for negotiation, appealing for ways of coming to a good solution. But recognising that this is a problem that has to be resolved. I think my own sense, and it's just a personal opinion, is that that over the last short time there seems to be some significant intervention from the international community. And I think the fact that things are not being highlighted on the international press at the moment would seem to me that there are negotiations from other parties like the African Union and the UN and other, obviously other governments intervening in the situation. One of my concerns, I would have to say, is that that often I ask, does the international media exacerbate or help the situation? Because I know that some of the information put out initially about borders and who owned what was actually not accurate. And therefore, these kind of situations need a lot of study of the context, the history, and what has happened in an area in order to be able to say definitively this area belongs to one or the other. And I think knee-jerk reactions aren't particularly helpful.
You were talking about negotiations, and we heard there on Thursday that Sudan had endorsed the African Union's roadmap. Based on that plan, the two countries have until next Tuesday. What are, do you think, the hopes for a negotiated settlement in reality?
For me, it's very hard to say what the hopes are. I suppose you have the hopes, the hope of everybody that there's a way forward peacefully. But always in every political situation, there's so many agendas. I suppose I often feel this is the time really for prayer, for the opening of hearts to one another, for the looking for the common good of all the people of this area, both of Sudan and of South Sudan, that there are great things at stake, and many have suffered for many long years, and a return to that kind of conflict, I think in a way is unconscionable if every effort hasn't been made, both at local level but also by the international community, to broker a way forward.
Just looking from the humanitarian perspective, what is life like in South Sudan with regard to people's everyday living? Are things very expensive? Do they have access to proper food, to things like that?
Well, I think food supplies have been affected, particularly if food that was coming from the north, then food that's coming from other locations has been hugely affected because of transport costs and the price in the market, or the availability of certain foods at certain times in the markets, just not there. I know if we look at the whole area of the Nuba Mountains, which I have mentioned, where the people are suffering in huge numbers, and just reading reports yesterday of the number who are coming down into the refugee camps in the south because they're starving and because they're unable to plant in the Nuba area because of the bombing raids and attacks. Then when you come in to look at the people who have been displaced, say, from the Abyei area, they're settled in camps in areas about 35 miles south of the area of Abyei. And life, in a sense, is going on as normally as possible, in the sense children are going to schools. We're training some teachers there, and you know, there's a sense of a normal rhythm of life. And in the whole of South Sudan, in a sense, there's a normality, but there's also a struggle, the struggle that any kind of tension will bring. And also you have rumours and rumours of war and rumours of attacks, and that has a very destabilising effect, I think, on people who have been traumatised by so many years of war. So I suppose my appeal to the international community is that a resolution be found, that a way forward be negotiated, even if it takes time, that the leaders come to the table, but also that we in the Universal Church, I think, are saying to the people of South Sudan, we are thinking of you, we are praying for you, your needs are not forgotten, and whatever... You know, at the international level, the plight and the cause of Sudan is well known.
What about people who have been displaced? A deadline has been extended for the return of South Sudanese to their country. What about that? Can South Sudan cope with these people coming in? What is the situation there?
Well, I suppose it depends when you're choosing between feeling at home somewhere and going home to land that you maybe left, or a place that you left decades ago. It's not an easy transition. I know around the area of Wawd, many returnees are still in camps, still waiting to be settled. And that's a slow process. But I feel the government of South Sudan is making every effort to settle those, the returnees, and also to take care of their needs as they return. But that's not easy for any country to cope with. when thousands of people arrive back. And again, the support of humanitarian agencies and of various international non-government organisations is vital in this situation. And I think the Caritas agencies worldwide are playing a very important role in the process, and helping with the needs of returnees as well as the needs of people who have been displaced. So there are many kind of areas of need. And as well as that, then you have the ordinary people who've been there, who have always been in South Sudan, who have never left, who are trying to build a new life. And this kind of disturbance in many parts of the country, life goes on much as usual, because it's an enormous country, as you know. But different areas are affected in different ways. I was reading, you know, recently in, say, the Lake State area, where they're looking for recruits in the event of a potential conflict. So that will affect the lives of families again. So I think this is it's a very delicate moment. And it's a moment, really, I think, that everybody needs to act responsibly. And I particularly, I think, appeal to the international media that not to exacerbate a situation, but to... Sometimes the stories about conflict and potential for conflicts are seen to be perhaps more interesting than the long, slow process of peace building, which isn't always so visible.
Just one final question, and just regarding the government of South Sudan, which is a new government, as it were. I mean, they're having to cope with a conflict, but also trying to build structures as well, trying to build educational structures, health structures, all the things that a running country needs. And I suppose it's a learning curve as well for a new government.
It is a learning curve, and obviously you're really building a new country from scratch. But there are many, many supporters in the international community, many governments, many intergovernmental funds, and then financial support from particular governments. I see that the president returned recently from a visit to China with the promise of a huge amount of aid to build roads and infrastructure and schools and hospitals and so forth. And that's the kind of focus that the country, in a sense, needs to be able to put its full mind and heart to building the resources that that the people need. And equally, I think the international communities and the faith-based communities are playing their role, as we are, for example, in solidarity with South Sudan, on behalf of the Catholic Church, helping to build teacher training colleges, and to we've renewed a health training institute in order to train teachers, nurses and midwives for South Sudan. And these are the leaders and the professional competencies that are needed in this new country. And so we pray God that peace will prevail, so that the real work of nation building can be done in a substantive way, and that all the parties under the leadership of the government and with the help and support of the churches can reach out and meet the needs of so many.